In a world where uncertainty reigns supreme, where shadows of chaos dance at every turn, one truth emerges unyielding. Preparation is not a luxury, but a lifeline. Behold the Wellness Company, a beacon of readiness amidst the tempestuous seas of fate. Envision a sanctuary of tranquility, where the tumult of unforeseen medical crises finds no purchase. The Wellness Company's Medical Emergency Kit stands as a bastion of assurance, a fortress of resilience against the unseen foes of health. Within its sacred confines lie the tools of salvation. Ivermectin, to ward off the insidious whispers of disease. Emergency antibiotics, to quell the raging storms of infection. Antivirals, to vanquish the relentless tides of contagion, and more. The Wellness Company Medical Emergency Kit is not merely a collection of supplies, it is the embodiment of preparedness itself. Crafted by the hands of esteemed healers led by luminaries such as Dr. Peter McCullough, Dr. James Thorpe, Dr. Harvey Risch, and Dr. Drew Pinsky, this kit stands as the pinnacle of safety, the zenith of prevention. These truth-seeking doctors have forged a testament to vigilance, a testament to the unwavering pursuit of well-being. Embrace the certainty that comes from being armed against adversity. Embrace the Wellness Company, for in its embrace lies the promise of resilience, the promise of a brighter tomorrow amidst the chaos of today. Don't wait for the next crisis to strike. Visit twc.health/strangeplanet and use promo code STRANGEPLANET for an exclusive 10% discount. Prepare today and rest easy tomorrow. There's a very common sense reason gold is pushing to all-time highs right now. Actually, there are several reasons. The cost of goods continues to rise despite interest rate controls by the Fed. Since Jan 21, the cost of living is up 17.9%. The national debt continues to skyrocket, now above $34 trillion, causing many to worry when the house of cards will come crashing down. A presidential election year that'll have massive implications on the future of this country. All of this adds up to instability and uncertainty, and that's why so many Americans are turning to Birch Gold Group. Have you diversified your savings yet? Secure a portion of them with gold from Birch Gold. Text STRANGE to 989898 and get your free info kit. You'll learn how to convert an existing IRA or 401k into a tax-sheltered IRA in gold, and it doesn't cost you a penny out of pocket. With an A-plus rating with the Better Business Bureau and tens of thousands of happy customers, you can count on Birch Gold, too. Just text STRANGE to 989898 to claim your free info kit and to protect your savings from uncertainty today.
The comfort of your favorite seat is now your comfy car-selling command center, thanks to Carvana.
It doesn't get any better than this.
Your favorite seat's the best spot in the house. Make it even better by entering your license plate or VIN and getting a real offer in minutes.
There really is no place like home.
And speaking of home, Carvana will pick up your car from yours after you finalize your offer. Visit Carvana.com or download the app and sell your car from your comfy place.
Richard Serrett's Strange Planet. Following the truth wherever it leads. Exposing evil and corruption and the secret machinations of powerful elites. Revealing the high strangeness beneath the surface of our supposed reality. Coming to you from the Great White North and his studio beneath the stairs. Here's Richard.
Welcome to another episode of Strange Planet. Thanks for sticking me in your ear, and welcome to part two of my conversation with Teresa and Daniel Duke, the great-great-grandchildren of the outlaw Jesse James.
Their 20 years plus of research, in addition to research by their late mother, Betty Dorset Duke, leads to the rather inescapable conclusion that Jesse James was not killed by Bob Ford in April of 1882, that he faked his death, took on an alias, James Lafayette Courtney, and lived out a very long life in Texas as a farmer. Again, Teresa and Daniel Duke, the co-authors of The Mysterious Life and Faked Death of Jesse James. Daniel Duke, the author of Jesse James and the Lost Templar Treasure, and the brand new book, Secret History of the Wild, Wild West. Just getting back to sort of the mythos of Jesse James, how did he, or why did he become known as America's Robin Hood? I mean, was he literally, like, you know, taking from the rich and helping poor people?
That's a good question. A good question. There were a lot of stories that Jesse had, and some of these were myths. Some of those were also based on stories by a journalist who was sympathetic to the James and Younger boys. His name was John Newman Edwards, and he would write like it was a fiery journalistic voice. It was always in support of the James boys and how they were done wrong. And like I've said before, I don't think they were psychopaths and, you know, horrible bloodthirsty killers like some have painted them. But I also would readily admit they weren't angels by any means. But there were stories that, like, one lady had owed taxes, and they were in that area. They heard the lady, you know, owed taxes. The tax collector was coming to either get the money or take her farm. And Jesse and his gang members gave her some money, told her to pay the taxpayer, and then they left and went and waited on the road. So after she paid the taxpayer, she got her receipt showing she paid the taxes. When he was riding back towards town, they robbed him and got their money back. And there was a lot of stories like that, but they're hard to prove, but stories like that got around real quick. People thought of Jesse as you know, a Robin Hood. And there was one quote by a Laura James I always loved. It was Jesse James represented every man who'd ever felt the boot of the man on their neck. And I thought that sentiment alone, along with the rumors, just seemed to catapult them into legendary Robin Hood status.
Right. And how much of the sort of the sympathetic version of Jesse James may have been fueled by, in the South, resentment during the Reconstruction era, the way that the, you know, the North treated the South? I mean, the slavery issue aside, I mean, let's face it, there were atrocities on both sides, and the Union during Reconstruction, pretty harsh on the South. How much do you think that the Reconstruction era sort of fueled the recasting of Jesse James as a hero and as a Robin Hood?
I think it had a lot to do with it. I'm glad you mentioned that the Reconstruction era, people lost, you know, everything they had. There were a lot of people who, if their business had been shown in some way to have supported the Confederacy, and when you're in the Deep South and you're not supporting them, you look like a traitor. So you're kind of caught between a rock and a hard place. But if their business had been shown in any way to have supported the Confederacy, the North, or what they call carpetbaggers, would take their property from them. And so, you know, people were very bitter. Their livelihood was lost. They had nothing left. And that, I'm sure, stories like that did nothing but serve the James gang and their reputation.
So,
well, and then there was a lot of things, you know, like people, I've heard a few people also argue that I agree with the point. You know, there was slavery was horrible. I don't agree with that at all. But at the same time, the Northern, you know, after the North won, they then went and wiped out a lot of Native American tribes. So it was kind of, you know, like it was you know, a bit hypocritical in ways. So people would see things like that, and I think that also helped towards, you know, help support the James gang story.
As of 1882, when Jesse faked his death, do we have any idea what kind of a fortune he and the gang had amassed? And, you know, when you add up all of the train robberies and the bank robberies and the steamboat robberies and stagecoach robberies, how much loot did they end up with?
That's a good question. I'm trying to remember the figures. Every time I think of that, I always think it doesn't add up to all the amounts of gold he was said to have buried in single catches.
Yeah, like one, you know, one was like the first one, Liberty, was like 60,000. There were others that were like in the amount of 3,000. So, I mean, I don't know the exact amount, but I mean, I do think that they got away with, you know, quite a large sum. Just that first one, $60,000 for back in the 1800s was, you know, that's a lot of money back then.
That would have to be worth several million dollars in today's dollars, I would think. I don't know.
Yeah. I mean, it was one bank robbery. Yeah, it was a lot.
And did they divvy up things? I mean, was the James gang, was it a dictatorship with Frank and Jesse ruling the roost, or was there, I don't know, did they divvy up things democratically? How did the gang run?
The way I understood it, they always, it was basically modeled after the way they did things when they were riding with Quantrill. But I think they were a little more democratic than that. They would discuss a target and basically vote on whether they thought it was right or not. And they had the right to sit out on one or not. Most of them, you know, they had the attitude, we ride together. But at the same time, there were times where they would also split up and hit multiple targets in the same areas within days of each other, and sometimes on the same day. So it was, that's another thing that also led to confusion. I think it was a great guerrilla tactic they probably learned during the Civil War. People would attribute it to Jesse, and yet sometimes it was Wood Height leading a group that rode into town, or Cole Younger or Frank James.
Right, so it was Beast Squad.
They didn't know exactly who they were chasing.
But for some reason, it was Jesse who seemed to stand out. I mean, with history, like I always say, you know, he had a brother, Frank. But you don't hear about Frank James much, or like the Youngers. I mean, you know, there's little bits throughout the history books on them, but it always seemed to focus on Jesse. And that, you know, I don't know why, you know, it worked out that way, but it panned out that way, but it all seems to be focused more on Jesse.
Right. And so by April of 1882, when Jesse fakes his death, Wood Height becomes Jesse James and is, you know, put into the ground. And that's supposedly the end of Jesse James. Jesse James heads to Texas as James Lafayette Courtney. Who's left in the James gang? And does all of that money revert to Jesse, or does Frank also have a big portion of that? Did they flee together? What happened?
And which I didn't hear which one you were talking about. Was that?
Jesse and Frank, when Jesse fakes his death in 1882, is Frank in on it? Does Frank flee with Jesse? What happened?
No. So Frank ended up going to trial after the supposed assassination of Jesse James, and ended up being acquitted of all charges. So we found that really interesting. So he didn't ever have to go into hiding, Frank James.
How is it possible that he eluded charges?
That's a good question. No, you go ahead, Teresa.
They took him to trial for, I want to say it was the murder of some, I don't remember who, but he was brought up in, like, you know, the robbery charges, but also murder charges. And he ended up being acquitted of everything. So he didn't have to go into hiding. And then I think he died. I want to say Frank James, he lived to be fairly old, but I think he died in, like, wasn't it like 1910 or something, Danny, or 1915?
I thought it was 1919.
I can't remember exactly, but right. Long story short, he didn't have to go into hiding like Jesse did.
Was he aware that Jesse was that had faked his death?
I'm sorry, you'll have to repeat that.
Did Frank know that Jesse had in fact faked his death?
Yes. And that's a good question. I always wondered if he knew right away or how long it took him to find out, because there were a lot of rumors flying around, and I'm sure that happens during any event like similar to that. that Frank was on his way to town and people were going to pay. And then I have a feeling he may not have known until he got in the area. He probably spoke to one of his friends, fellow gang members, or one of his family members and found out. And then when he found out, he backed off. I'm not sure how that would have worked out, but that's a good question. I've always wondered, and my guess, my best guess would be that he got word from a trusted source, and that's when he found out.
So how do we pick up the trail from St. Joseph, Missouri in April of 1882 to James Lafayette Courtney, gentleman farmer in Texas, who lived right up until the 1940s, I believe. How did you pick up that trail, and how do we find out that he was Jesse James?
Can I say one thing before we move on to that?
It's
regarding Frank and his wife, Ann Ralston. They did a news story with her shortly before she died, and she made the comment, she was 91 when she died, but she made the comment that the true story of Frank and Jesse would go to the grave with her. So I think that they had to be in on it as well. Frank, I think he personally did know about Jesse's, you know, that he did fake his death and move to Texas, because she moved to Texas as well.
And Ann Ralston was who, sorry?
After Frank died.
Who was Ann Ralston?
Frank James's wife.
Ah, okay. All right.
Yeah, and they did an article with her a couple of months before she died. She was 91, but she did state that the true story of Jesse and Frank would go to the grave with her.
Ah, okay. That's
so I think he probably, I personally think that, you know, Frank was in on it the whole time.
Right. Okay. So take us from St. Joseph, Missouri to James Courtney Lafayette's, or sorry, James Lafayette Courtney's farm in Texas.
Okay. Well, Jesse had been living in Texas since 1871. He came to Texas, met my third great grandfather, Thomas Hudson Barron, who was a captain with the Texas Rangers. And when I heard that, I thought, okay, this is wild. But it was known, our late mother had found proof that, and there were old wanted posters of four wanted posters for Jesse and Frank and the Youngers, saying that they were known to have ridden with Texas Rangers around the Dallas, Texas area. So, and you know, I thought, well, it's not actually that strange, because they'd all fought on the same side during the war, and some of them probably fought together. Some of the Texas, and a lot of Texas Rangers, especially back in those days, had ridden both sides of the fence, so to speak, that many of them used to be outlaws and then became lawmen, and some would just jump back and forth throughout their career.
Oh, I didn't know. Fascinating.
So, yeah, I always thought that was pretty interesting. But in 1871, and we have his diary from 1871 up through 1876, and it wasn't a normal diary. Like, he didn't talk about his feelings. It was more of a day book. He'd write down the facts. So, but he mentioned where, you know, places everywhere he'd gone. He even signed his name Jesse, J. James, and also JWJ, his initials, which were Jesse Woodson James. He'd written the name James L. J.L. Courtney many times on the back, almost as if he were practicing that new signature. But in addition to that, he'd mentioned known gang members that he'd ridden with that lived in that area at different times, and a lot of different facts that actually served. Without that day book, we wouldn't have been able to crack a lot of that. So, you know, it was the confusion was caused by him because he needed to, but just to get away and you know, live a peaceful life. But at the same time, his day book also unopened and unraveled a lot of that confusion.
So he married, settled down, and where was his spread? Where in Texas? Where was his farm?
It was Levin, Texas. Levin's, Texas, and it was not too far from Waco, Texas.
It's about probably, well, back then it would have been about a day's ride southeast of Waco, Texas. Now it is about an hour.
How many acres?
180. I think it was 180 acres that he'd purchased from his father-in-law, Thomas Barron.
And did he buy it with gold? Or?
He purchased it with gold, all with gold. I think it was $800, and he paid for it all in gold coins.
Wow.
When he rode into Texas, he had saddlebags with gold coins.
And what kind of a farmer was he?
He wasn't. He didn't ever seem too busy based on his day book. He was always, it was always someone else doing the work, or he would just, he didn't seem busy at all. I mean, he would do things like, you know, brand a calf, things like that. And a lot of the time he was going into town and buying things for his wife and children. But he didn't seem, he would cut like a half an acre of tall grass or reeds and different things like that. But it wasn't a whole lot of work, especially for those times. I mean, usually a farmer was working from sun up to sun down, and he seemed to live pretty leisurely.
Right, but he didn't need to work because he had, well, what do we know? What was he worth in terms of, well, let's just look at the gold. How much did he owe? Did he have like buckets of gold around the house?
Yeah, he had
gold buried. And he also, there's a story about his son. His son's name was Byron Courtney, but he gave a job to Byron to count. He had gold in a trunk, and every day he would have Byron count that gold every day to make sure, that no one was dipping into it. But he had, that was one story, he had a trunk full of gold in his house, and he would also bury gold in jars in his yard.
Wow.
And he also had, he was fond of the Ford cars, and every year he would have a new car on hand. Like he had to have a new car. He was always buying new Ford vehicles back then.
What was he concerned? Did he think that one day someone's gonna, you know, catch up with me and figure all of this out? I mean, was he nervous that he was going to be apprehended?
I believe so, and I think Danny can agree with me on this, but in his journal, people would come to his farm, and they would introduce themselves, and he would always say in the journal, or so they say. Like, to me, that seemed like he was paranoid. Like, they would come introduce themselves for whatever reason that they were going out to visit on the farm, and then he would say, so-and-so came today. And then he would say their names, and then it would say, or so they say. Like, I felt like there was a hint of paranoia with anybody who would come to his farm.
Well, and also when he would, if someone rode up to his house after dark, he would always blow out all the candles or all the lanterns in the house, and he would draw his gun and lay down across the floor next to the front door. So I was assuming if they came in, they'd trip over him, and I don't think they would expect someone shooting from the floor if that's what they were planning on doing. He seemed pretty paranoid.
Right. Yes. How was he with a gun? How was he with a gun?
They also, he did get the attention of the government because they were always sending him letters wanting to know how he had all the assets that he had. So we do have some letters where the government was like, explain this, how you have this and how you have that. So he did have to deal with that as well.
How was he with a gun?
Oh, there was actually, we had an eyewitness account or eyewitness to that that we had met. His name was George Roaming. He's passed since. George was a young boy when Jesse was an older man, and I was thrilled to just meet someone who had spoken to Jesse. George grew up in the area. He was about 9 or 10 years old, and he said Jesse would wave to him up, you know, to come sit on the porch with him and have lemonade. And George said Jesse would talk to him, and he was always scared to death of him just because he said he was a big man with a big hat and a great big mustache, and he always had a big gun next to him. So he said one day Jesse told him to carry a stone out 40 paces across the yard and set it down. And when George got back, he said Jesse stood up, stepped off the porch, and before his foot hit the ground, he shot the rock. You know, he just drew his pistol and shot it. And he was in his 80s at the time. So, you know, I'd say he was a very good shot. There were also stories that before they would have, if his wife wanted to cook chickens, some chicken for the family, he would get on his horse sometimes and show off for his kids, and he would ride by at full gallop and shoot the head off of a chicken. I'd say it was a good shot.
Sounds like it. All right, we'll take another time out. And if you're in the live chat, get your questions and comments ready, and my live stream producer, Ryan, will curate those and send those on to me, and I'll put those questions to Teresa and Daniel Duke as we continue our discussion on the outlaw Jesse James. Back with more in a moment.
Without the ones like you who work tirelessly to keep things running, everything would suddenly stop. Hospitals, factories, schools, and power plants, they all depend on you. No matter the weather, emergency, or time of day, you're the ones who get it done. At Grainger, we're here for you with professional-grade industrial supplies. Count on real-time product availability and fast delivery. Call, clickgrainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
It's time to redefine reality. This is Richard Serrett's Strange Planet.
Teresa and Daniel Duke, great-great-grandchildren of the outlaw Jesse James, who faked his death in April of 1882 and lived under the alias James Lafayette Courtney as a farmer in Texas. How long did he live?
Seven. It was in 1943 when he died.
And I'm sorry, how old was he again?
97.
97. Wow. And how many children did he have?
Like seven.
Seven children.
Total?
He had seven children.
Yeah, and we also know that there are other diaries out there. We don't have those in our possessions, but what I find interesting is he had such a long life. He would mention things like an airplane, and he would put it in his journal. He would call it a flying machine, just went over his house. Like, those are the things I would love to see, because, you know, just seeing this outlaw who was from the, you know, Civil War time and the Western days, and I would love to see those journals that mentioned, you know, like his first, when he drove his first car, or seeing the plane in the sky. It's just things like that. That's what I would just love to see. I would love to find those journals and see that for myself. That there's just so much history, a span of history in there, you know, that you just can't get in a lot of stuff. And he had a lot of history.
Right, right. Let's go to the YouTube live chat with some questions here. And we're going to begin with Not Gordian, as in Gordian Knot. Not Gordian asks, what happened to Jesse James' revolvers?
That's a good question. I think most of them probably are scattered to the ends of the earth, but there were a couple we've seen. There was one we know for a fact was his, and we tried to, the man who owned it lived about 2 miles from where Jesse's farm was. He wanted more than we had at the time, but he said he would hold on to it. And before, right when we got the money to get it, he had passed away, and his family upped the price. They increased the price threefold, so we never got it.
Would there be any way of authenticating that pistol?
we did. We did as much as we could, and everything about the pistol lined up with everything we knew about Jesse. But he also carved inside the handle were the initials of other known gang members, and it just seemed too. We would have to, of course, we would want to take it to professionals so they would be able to examine it and make sure. But it everything about it seemed right on the money.
Did he let anyone in on the secret in Texas? Any of it? Did he ever tell his children, or did he have a best friend, a confidant in Blevins, Texas, that he actually said, you know what, you know, maybe over a beer or too many beers, I'm Jesse James.
We believe some of his family members knew, like it was passed down in our family through his daughter, Ida. She knew, and that's how it was passed down through us. I mean, we've heard it our entire lives. My mom heard it when she was a kid, and, well, you know.
Yeah, and a lot of the gang members, well, some of the gang members and a lot of the former Quantrill guerrillas who had ridden with him lived all around that area.
And George knew, Danny.
Yeah, I know George. Yeah, that's true. George knew.
Yeah.
Who's George?
Actually, George was the former World War II vet I'd mentioned earlier that we met. He was the one who told me the story of Jesse shooting the rock. George was sworn to secrecy by Jesse before Jesse hired him to help him move 700 bars of gold about 18 to 20 miles from Jesse's house.
Wow. All right. Robert S. Scott asks, do Daniel and Teresa have to deal with any backlash due to the family connection with Jesse James?
Sorry, Danny.
Oh, go ahead. Well, there was a man I met at my first book signing, and I didn't know what to think, really. I didn't expect it. The guy came up and said, you know, your ancestor shot my ancestor and killed him. What do you think of that? And I didn't know what to say. I just said, well, I guess he should have been a better shot. And I didn't know in hindsight, I would have said it differently, but just little things like that. I don't really know how you would, I'm not going to apologize for something I didn't do.
Exactly. But
I've heard people criticize it and people who find it fascinating. And, you know, I've just learned to come to the realization that, you know, we have the facts laid out in the books. We have documented, you know, evidence pointing to him being Jesse James. And some people can see it and believe it. And then there's others who just don't want to acknowledge any of it. So, you know.
Was there any consideration to exhuming the grave, determining whether it was Woodhight or Jesse James? Was there a exhumation?
Oh, yeah. In 1995, the James Farm and Museum and people associated with that hired Professor James E. Starrs, who was a law professor from the University from Georgetown University. And he had no back. His hobby was forensics, but he wasn't a professional in that field, which I thought was interesting. If anything dealing with history, they should have a professional doing it, someone who was qualified in that field. But they hired a law professor to do this. And no pun intended, but our late mother shot that whole exhumation full of holes. There was multiple mistakes. I mean, it was enough mistakes they made to fill several chapters, including Stephen Caruso, who was the attorney. He was a Clay County attorney at the time. He told my mother and I in person that it was a tawdry sideshow, and he's even said that on film. He said the hair they tested he was ordered by the court. He held the sample of Jesse's hair for the museum. Well, the court had ordered him to turn the hair over to James Starrs, and he said he didn't trust the guy. So instead of turning that hair over, he pulled the hair out of the Clay County Parks Director's hair, John Hartman, out of his head and submitted that. And what made me laugh, I mean, it's sad that it got that messed up, but they tested that hair, and on a documentary claimed that was Jesse's hair or met all the requirements to be Jesse's hair. Mm. And I thought, that's insane. I mean, he pulled his friend's hair. And the tooth they tested, Stephen Caruso said, I can guarantee you it had similar origins, but he wouldn't say where the tooth came from.
In other words, it didn't come from the body in the grave, supposedly, you know, belonging to Jesse James. It came from somewhere else.
Exactly.
All right. Wei Wei Anella asks, do you think the Clint Eastwood movie, The Outlaw Josie Wales, was based on Jesse James' life story? I hear similarities between the movie plot and Jesse's story.
I do think that. I think it was very, it was, reading, watching Josie Wales was almost, it was very close, almost identical to the story of not only Jesse, but a lot of the other gorillas who rode with him.
We just have about a minute, 2 minutes or a minute and a half here. I want to just talk briefly, and, you know, we have to have you back on and talk about the gold and the fact that he hid gold all over the place and left maps. And you alluded to this earlier, Teresa, when you were talking about there was this higher purpose behind these bank robberies. It wasn't just, you know, take these ill-gotten gains and for their own personal benefit. So first of all, let's talk about the maps that you have in your possession.
Okay. Well, you know, when my mom first started her research, her aunt gave her one of Grandpa Courtney's maps. She just gave it to her to continue with the research, and she was hoping that maybe she would eventually find the treasure from the map. Yeah, I mean, we have some of his maps, you know, and hopefully one day we'll find some treasure out of it. But if not, it's still interesting just knowing that we have some of his maps. But we do know that he buried a lot of his stuff under his house in Texas, and a lot of his kids were always trying to dig up the gold. Even when he died and they were burying him, his son, Byron Courtney, instead of attending his own father's funeral, was trying to dig up the gold, some of the gold in his at his house.
All right, I'm going to take a quick time out here. Teresa, Daniel, stay with us, back with more of our conversation about the outlaw Jesse James and your questions from the YouTube live chat. Keep them coming. Stay tuned for more.
Welcome back. Welcome back to Richard Serrett's Strange Planet.
An amazing story. The great-great-grandchildren of the outlaw Jesse James, who faked his death in 1882 and lived out his life in Blevins, Texas, and lived to the ripe old age of 97 as a very wealthy farmer. We'll go back to the YouTube live chat question in just a moment, but I just wanted to talk some more about the maps where he buried gold. I mean, where primarily did, according to these maps, did he bury this gold?
Well, that was when the map was passed down, a lot of people in the family had looked for it before it made it into our late mother's hands. And we gave a shot at it, you know, and it was hard just because it was geometrical designs, had a lot of dashes, and he had some code written in there. And the code wasn't too hard to finally figure out. It was just numbers substituted for letters and vice versa. But he would base it on the alphabet backwards or the alphabet forwards and different things like that. But the hard part was there were no geographic markers. It was just a geometrical designs drawn down with numbers and amounts of gold and silver and even greenbacks. He called them greenbacks that he had buried. So there was no starting point, like, you know, 40 paces north of the old oak tree. It was just a design, and you had to know a lot of backstory. There was a lot of questions. So I put that on the back burner, and over time, like George Roaming, the elderly gentleman who knew Jesse when Jesse was old and George was young, he had told this about another site, the one that he had helped Jesse move 700 bars of gold close to 20 miles away from Jesse's house. So that gave us another spot, and I thought, okay, I need at least one more location if I could, in that sense, to try to figure out where he had it. If there was any rhyme or reason to the areas where he would bury them. And that, a few years later, got answered when a former attorney general for the state of Texas, Wagner Carr, had sent his driver out. He was talking to our late mother a lot on the phone about Jesse, and he was also interested in the gold. Well, he sent his driver out to show my mother and I where several large catches were buried. And after I plotted those on the map, I noticed it all fell in line with a template. And that template, over time, it just working on it for years, it finally all fell into place. And it covered, it's a grid system that covers not only Texas, but most of the Americas. Not every spot on the grid has a treasure on it, but in an area where a treasure is, it's right on the grid. Any treasure that they had buried, or their organization, which ties into Freemasons and others, any treasure they had buried, was all that grid was right on the money. And not only with that, but also areas of historical interest, kind of like Scott Walter's Hooked X, the rune stone.
Yes.
It falls on that grid.
Fortis King asks from the YouTube live chat, about this gold, how much, and is there still any around today? So according to these maps, because he sort of itemized the amount of gold and silver, how much buried treasure is out there?
I think there's still a lot out there. There were large catches that were very large, kind of like Victoria Peak in New Mexico, where there was over, at the time in the 1940s, it was valued at around $3 billion, which would
Daniel, did you say $3 billion?
That's right. $3 billion. And LBJ even had his hands in that too, later on. But if that was a lot of money, $3 billion. I don't know how much that would be worth today, but that's enough to set a person up and generations of a family for a long time. But that was one, and that one was recovered. There were a few other very large ones like that around the Americas. But I think the smaller ones, even a jar full of gold, like an old mason jar, would be a small fortune, and that'd be enough to set most people up for the rest of their life.
Those gold caches that were discovered, and you say LBJ had a hand in one, were they verified as belonging to Jesse James?
No, that one wasn't. That predated Jesse. It even predated the founding of America. That one, I think, that people have. There were rumors that Chief Victorio, chief of the Apaches, had buried it there after killing, you know, or robbing wagon trains. And I thought, there's no way he buried $3 billion worth of gold deep in a cavern, and it was smelted gold bars. And what pioneer would have been traveling with smelted gold bars? If they had that, they would have had enough money to sell around the horn and, just to sell around instead of cross it in a wagon.
Let me go back to the YouTube live chat here with a question from Rob asking, who owns Jesse's farm now?
That would be Clay County, Missouri. It's a county up in they're about 30 minutes north of Kansas City, Missouri.
I think he's referring to the farm in Texas. My apology. I should have clarified.
Oh, I'm sorry. The farm in Texas would be owned. It was owned. I don't know if I should say the man's name, but it's when Jesse died, several of his children got in a big fight, legal fight over who got the farm. They were fighting. They got lawyers. The lawyers ended up getting it, and they sold it to a family who owns it to this day. I don't know if I should say their name.
No, the name's not important, but it's no longer in the Courtney family. Let's put it that way, or the Duke family.
That's right.
And is there a lot of squabbling over the? I mean, you have a map. Are there other descendants of Jesse James who claim that they also have a map? And has this caused any friction in the family?
The main friction we've had were some of my cousins. They'll come out and they want to know more, but they only care about the gold. They don't care about the history behind it. And they usually just, if they want to know that if I ever find any, that they get their share. And they seem to think they're owed a share just because they're descended. And it's not just that. They had approached, some of them had approached our late mother and asked her if there was ever a movie made on her book, if she was going to share any money she got with them from a movie. And they had never bothered to help research or anything, but they sit back and watch, and they just want a cut of the money because they're related. They don't want to do the work to actually help. That's the part. That's where the fighting had come in a little, not much, but mom just told them, no, you didn't help. You didn't donate. You didn't offer to help. So you're not owed anything.
If you were to find any of that gold, Would you have to turn that over to the U.S. Treasury because it was stolen?
I don't. That's a good question. I've never.
Our idea was to give it back to the Freemasons. We were like, what would we do if we find the treasure? And we always said to, like, you know, give it back to the Freemasons because we know that they would probably, you know, give it out. They would do good with it, like charities and, you know, good things with the treasure that they, you know, Jesse and them took. But I don't know. That's what we always ask that question. What would we do if we found it?
So R.E. on the live chat asks, is there a connection between Jesse James and the Knights Templar? I mean, the title of the second book, Jesse James and the Lost Templar Treasure, and Daniel, you've been on with me before and we've discussed this, and there are all of these strange sort of Masonic symbols on these maps. And is there a connection between Jesse and the Knights Templar?
There are. Through the Freemasons. Jesse, under his alias, was a Freemason here in Texas. And I don't know when his first contact with Freemasonry was. I suspect it was during the Civil War, just because Albert Pike was a brigadier general who was often in Arkansas and Oklahoma. And there's documented records showing that Quantrill's men would be in they would share a camp with Albert Pike and his men at different times. So I don't know if that's when Jesse became acquainted with Freemasonry or not, but under his alias, he was a Mason, and I traced Masonry back. You can trace even a lot of Masons. There's rumors and people who weren't too sure about it, but I was very confident after the research in my first book, the Jesse James and the Lost Templar Treasure. I showed that Freemasonry connects directly back to the Templar through Sir Francis Bacon, his mentor, John Dee, and it goes back through various alchemists, Rosicrucians, Jewish rabbis, all the way back to the a rabbi known as Rashi, who was a favored court guest of Hugh de Champagne, one of the founders of the Templar. And the thing, when I wrote the book, I thought, okay, people are really going to think I've gone off the deep end here. But what made my day, it made my entire decade, all the decades I've researched this, was the current Grand Master of the Knight Templar, Timothy Hogan, wrote a glowing endorsement for that book, and it's printed on the book, and it's saying that I have indeed cracked part of the code dealing with the treasures and the Knight Templar, well, the Knight Templar and the treasures from the temple in Jerusalem. And that just made my day.
Do you think that big gold cache worth $3 billion, was that in fact Templar treasure that the Templars brought over from Europe because they were being persecuted and pursued by the Vatican because of their, you know, they were challenging the power of kings and queens. They had so much wealth. There's some theory that they, you know, they deposited some of that treasure at Oak Island off of Nova Scotia and buried it elsewhere in the Americas. I think the intention was, you know, that gold would be used to create, turn America into the new Jerusalem or something to that effect. Was that $3 billion cache of gold, not Templar gold?
I believe that part of it was. I would think a large part of it probably was. Not only that cache, but also in Williamsburg, Virginia, the alleged cache in Nova Scotia, which is also on the grid pattern, the template. There's a lot of different treasures that came from, I believe, France, and well, ultimately originated from the temple, the Templar treasures.
So did your great-great-grandfather, Jesse James, think that he was then part of that tradition and that he also was burying gold to be used for that higher purpose that you alluded to earlier, Teresa?
I believe he was part of that.
Yep, I do believe that he was a part of, you know, I believe it was all carried down within the organization, and he was a part of it and a part of the goal for the higher purpose to be used later on down in the future. Although I'm not sure what it is their plans are for in the future, though. I do believe it was for a higher purpose.
Going back to the YouTube live chat, You Betcha asks, what are your favorite myths, lores, etc. about Jesse James? Any stories in particular that should be taken with a grain of salt?
That's a good question. Oh, God, there's a lot of favorite stories. Trying to pick one is harder than I thought it would be. Well, the Robin Hood legends I thought were interesting. They're funny. one in particular right off the top of my head, the robbery of the Achebach Brothers Bank in Corydon, Iowa, always gave me a laugh because they had ridden into town to rob the bank. Get to town, the streets are empty. Everybody's on the other side of the town listening to Henry Clay Dean give a speech. And Mark Twain had mentioned Henry Clay Dean. He was a famous fiery orator. He was a filthy man, but he gave great speeches. So he drew the whole town to the other side of town. He's given a speech. The James boys waltz in, rob the bank, no resistance. They leave, and as they're leaving, they ride by the crowd and say, "Hey, the bank was just robbed." People in the crowd turned around and shushed them. They didn't want them interrupting the speech. And the gang just rode on out of town. By the time the town found out the bank was robbed, they were long gone.
How about you, for you, Teresa? That's a good one. How about for you, Teresa? A famous piece of Jesse James lore?
I think for me, it's just the fact that in the guerrilla days, Jesse was always, according to the legends, he was a daredevil. Pat showed no fear, and he was always the front and center and taking on the other side with no fear. And I don't know, I find that fascinating. I like to think that he was like a daredevil like that. No fear, he was bold.
R. Davis asks, are there any ties from Jesse James to Italian royalty?
That's a good question.
That is a good question.
I'm not sure.
I'm not sure why he's trying to make that connection, or why she's trying to make that connection. Have you heard that before?
I haven't.
Mm-mm.
All right. I'm not sure exactly.
That's something to check into.
Well, I do know one. Well, not Italian royalty. I have heard of connections with some people, some more recent outlaws from the 30s and 40s who had ties allegedly, but they weren't so much mafia or Italian. But they were tied in with, they were connected to some Italian mafia, but not Italian royalty that I know of.
What about Jesse James and the other great outlaw, Billy the Kid? Any connection there?
Oh, yeah. Billy and Jesse had met in Las Vegas, New Mexico in 1879. And that was well documented. They had allegedly met to discuss teaming up to form a new gang. And that didn't happen. But what I found interesting was just within a couple of years of that meeting, they both were allegedly assassinated by people they had ridden with and shot in the back.
Mm.
Or shot in certain, similar circumstances. It almost makes me wonder if that wasn't planned, because there's a lot of evidence on that Billy had also faked his death. And I don't know how... I can't guarantee, I haven't researched that in depth like we have the Jesse James story, but it makes me really curious.
All right. A final point. R. Davis, who was asking about a connection to an Italian monarchy, I'm just looking in the YouTube live chat. He says, I have documents. So R. Davis, if you want to, can they contact you through the website? Either of you?
Is it
author Dan Dukes?
Yeah, we'd love to see that.
Okay, so R. Davis, yeah, go to the website. I've linked up to it at strangeplanet.ca. Just click on Daniel and Teresa's name, and that'll take you to the website, and you can contact them. I'm sure they'd like to see or know more about these documents connecting their great-great-grandfather, Jesse James, with Italian royalty. We'll have to do it again. There's so much more to discuss in the secret of the wild, wild west. Teresa and Dan, thank you so much.
Thanks for having me. It's an honor.
A new Richard Serrett's Strange Planet drops every Monday, Wednesday, and Friday.